Welcome to Juno Afternoon. It is September 6th. I'm Andy Klein, your fill-in host for today, filling in for Boston Christopher, who's taking a well-deserved break and happy to be here on a Wednesday. Coming up today, the Platypus Gaming Convention. Yes, Platypus Con is going to be coming up. It's a board and card game extravaganza. It's happening all this coming up weekend at Centennial Hall. We'll hear from some of the organizers, and maybe I might even get explained a few of the games. That'll be pretty good. We're going to also be hearing from the organizers of a panel discussion. The cruise industry impacts a lot of life here in Juneau, and that discussion is going to look at some of the health, quality of life, and economic impacts of cruises in Juneau. And the UAS Evening at Egan Fall Lecture Series begins September 8th with Fulbright scholar Dr. Shingo Hamada, who talks about the history and impact that herring have had on communities in the North Pacific. That's all ahead, and I hope you'll stay with us. And in the forecast, rain is in the extended forecast, and that's all I'm going to say about that. Yeah, it's September, and it's feeling a little bit like September today, but that's okay, because we can head inside and hang out with friends and explore games and gaming, and that is the point of Platypus Con, Platypus Gaming Con that's coming up, and Joshua Warren and Shay Wilson are with me to talk all about this annual event that is a three-day extravaganza of boarding. Well, you guys, how would you describe it? I'll throw it to you.
It's just a great weekend full of fun board games all weekend long. Just a giant hall where people can play and learn games.
And, you know, you guys are going to be one of the first. I think you're going to be one of the first things that's in New Centennial Hall, right? I mean, New Centennial Hall is going to be nice.
It looks really nice. We've gotten a few peeks, and it looks pretty nice in there.
Yeah, very cool. And so it's board and card games. So for people who maybe haven't been tracking lately, this has exploded, right? I mean, the variety and the types and the intricacies of board games and card games has really exploded in the past, I'd say, maybe 20 years. Do I have that right? Is it even more compressed, or is it even longer?
Yeah, what, like 25 years? A lot of people date it back to Catan, which is a strategy game that's very, very popular. But the genres just keep expanding. One of the newest things is legacy games, where you play over a campaign for a series of games. People really like that.
Oh, that's interesting. So yeah, I grew up with, like, I remember one of my favorites was Stratego. I remember that. I loved that. Risk, of course, and those kinds of things. So those were like the strategy games of the time. But then I have a couple of buddies, Pat Reyes, Aaron Suring, are buddies of mine that own Alaska Robotics. So they get really into that stuff. And so my eyes were open, wide open, right, to this whole new world, because it seemed like, you know, for a long time, and when my childhood, Milton Bradley and Parker Brothers owned all the board games, it seemed like. And that's what you had. You had those board games. And that really changed. And you're saying it's that game that sort of maybe spawned that change in a little bit of a way? Or
I mean, there was – Catan was a big one. It was big in Germany, and then it came over, and – There was a lot of European board games that started to make the crawl over, and then more and more American creators started making more. There's always been a lot of, like, dice chucking kind of games, like Risk. Those were always sort of popular in the U.S., but some of the more thinky, head scratching ones were in Europe, and so now they're all over here and they're getting mixed together. So now there's games where you're fighting with dice, but it's still thinky and stuff like that.
That's cool. It seems like, I mean, there also just there a lot of the games seem to have a sort of touch on the D&D element a little bit too, and like that kind of stuff as well. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, we have a lot of games that allow you to role play, and then a lot of dungeon crawling and wargaming, depending on which side of D&D you like, because it has a lot of facets. And there will be tabletop gaming also there. So D&D is as well. If you've always wanted to learn to play and don't know how to get started, that'll be there.
That can be intimidating, right? You don't know what, you know, dungeon master, whatever, you know, and all that stuff. So to have someone that to have a group that's coaching along the newbies, right? It's pretty cool.
And they'll be gentle with you.
Yeah, that's right. I find it also fascinating, and talk to me a little bit about this, but in this age where computer games, of course, are astounding and amazing and mind-blowing, there's this been this rise of the analog, you know, of the physical, tactile games. What do you think is happening there?
I really enjoy being able to socialize with people. I'm not great when I don't have something, a penumbra going around it. So being able to play a board game gives me a chance to have something we're doing while still talking with friends. And I also find it's a really great way to bond with new people, because we're really hoping that both you'll bring your friends and play games, but maybe you'll come and meet some new friends to play games with, and it's a good shared experience. So I think having something to bond over has really helped board gaming expand as well.
It's really true. I can't imagine just sitting around a table not playing a game for 6 hours, you know, but you can sit around a table and play a game for 6 hours and it's like a blink. Yeah.
Yeah, someday I need to play Twilight Imperium, which supposedly takes like 8 to 10, which is why I have not found time for it yet.
Well, this is good. So this is the next thing I wanted to talk to you about, some specific games. Like, so what are sort of, if you were to list right now, even people that maybe are into gaming, maybe there's a couple of games they might not have heard of, or they're new on the scene, or like they're the talk of the scene. So what are a couple of examples of those that are happening right now?
Well, I'm really digging Merchant Guild of Explorers. It's quick. I have a family, so I never have extra time. So I prefer games that are under an hour. And Merchant Guild of Explorers, you get cards that you're exploring a map, and you're doing it simultaneously with up to four other people, and exploring ruins and treasures by going to different points on the map, and whoever gets the most points, coins, wins. Everyone seems to like it. It's quick, it's easy, it's understandable. Mm-hmm. So I'm really digging that game right now.
And I think we have that as a demo this year, I think.
Yeah. You know.
I was amazed when I was, like I said, I'm relating to this experience of playing with Aaron one time. And, you know, when we used to play board games, I remember us getting them out and like not really reading the rules, you know, like we'll figure it out. But these games, it's like the first thing you have to do is at least have one person who's kind of a bit of an authority on the rules as you're playing.
It can definitely be very daunting. That's my task generally in our friend group, is to be the person who's read the rules and can teach the game. And I really enjoy doing so. A lot of times I won't even play because we have more players than it plays, because I just enjoy teaching. But that's one of the other things we really try to hit at Platypus, is we have 8 games a day that are, we have people there and ready to teach you how to play. So you don't need to read the rule book. If you want to try out a game and read the rule book yourself, you're welcome to do so. But we're also happy to help you jump into a game really easily.
Of the games, so you they're kind of split into board games and card games, right? But then there's also some hybrids, right? That cards involve boards and versus that kind of thing, right? So the one that you were just mentioning, the Guild, was it
Merchant Guild of Explorers.
Merchant Guild of Explorers. Is that card or board or combo?
It's you have a board that you're exploring, but the cards tell you where you can move.
Is there a game out right now that's strictly a card game that's like, this is the game? This is, I mean, like, I remember Magic the Gathering and those kinds of ones, but is there other?
Pure card game that I like the best right now is called Cat in the Box. And it's like Hearts, so it's a trick-taking game. But none of your cards have a suit until you tell everyone what suit it is. So it's pretty chaotic, but I still love it. It's great because Shay here is really good at card counting, and he can't card count when he doesn't know what suit my card is. So essentially, you play a 3, and this 3 is a heart. You can't be the next. You can't, once a 3 of heart gets played, you can't play another. But he doesn't know until I decide what it is.
Right.
It's frustrating, actually.
And that's an interesting thing, too, is there's these developments on strategy that have happened, right? Like, at this point, people who've been playing these games for a while, they kind of know the tricks of the trade, right? So there's always a little bit of an arms race into strategies kind of stuff. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, I mean, not to stick too hard into the trick-taking, but one of the things that really blew my mind in the last few years was a game called The Crew, which is a trick-taking game again, but this now it's cooperative. So you're trying to make sure certain people say take certain tricks, and it just never would have occurred to me, but it's really not that big of a change from, like, it plays exactly like Hearts. It's just now you have to work together instead of work against each other.
Do you have a partner? But
the whole table's working together.
Yeah. Collaboratively.
So like you start the game and be like, Josh needs to win the third trick. And so you need to make sure to play cards in a way that guarantees that I'm going to win the third trick.
Oh, really interesting. Wow, that's really cool. You mentioned trick games, and that's sort of like we would, you know, as we imagine Hearts or Spades or even a lot of the things that are kind of derivative of Bridge even. But what are other card games that aren't like trick games? What are some of the classifications that are of card games?
Drafting would probably be the other big one, where essentially everyone's given a set number of cards. You get to pick one, and then you give the rest of your hand to your neighbor. And so you sort of know what cards are at the table and what cards are going to be available. It's always really hard because you could have, of the seven cards you got dealt, there's three cards you really want, and you know you're not going to see anything you don't pick, you're not going to see again because someone else is going to take it from you. So that's probably one of the other big ones.
Now, when you're talking about these games, is it using a traditional deck of cards?
Most of the time, not.
Okay, right. Yeah. It's something completely different, or it's at least, like, as you were saying, doesn't have a suit because the suit is determined later, or things like that. Okay.
The big one is probably Seven Wonders for drafting. It's probably 10 years old at this point. But
what about for you? We heard from Josh about one of his favorite board game kind of things that's out now. What about for you?
I think the one I'm looking forward to right now, hearkening back to the legacy, like Shay said, is a game called Sagrada Artisans. So Sagrada is a game about making a stained glass window, and you use colored translucent dice. But Sagrada Artisan is a legacy game, so that means every game you're going to change something permanently in the game to change it up and make each thing changes. And normally, once you're done playing the game, it's sort of you throw it away, but I get enough enjoyment out of it, it doesn't matter that I'm going to be throwing it away. But so it looks like the new one is essentially a coloring book. So instead of using dice, you have a nice set of colored pencils and you're coloring in based on what choices you make in the game. And I'm looking forward to playing that one. We won't have that one at the con. I'm hoping we'll have it in January. But
are there big producers, like houses of games, producers, like really well-known brands that are making these types of games? Is it very much more independent focused now? How's the world of gaming kind of?
I would say Asmodee is the Milton Bradley of the age.
Okay. Asmodee. Asmodee, okay.
They've been buying a lot. There's still a ton of small independent game designers, but they've been buying a lot of them up.
And Asmodee, like, what are some of the ones that, you know, gamers know, oh, yeah, Asmodee makes this one.
I mean, they own so many, like, and they publish under other names. Like, Fantasy Flight would be one of the big ones they do now. And I like Imperial Assault from them, and it's a Star Wars dungeon crawl kind of thing. So you're not playing as Luke. You're playing as the B squad, but you still can be a Jedi if you want to be. So
that's cool. Well, that's a cool thing too, that all these things can incorporate other pop culture references, other institutions that people are really excited about as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of Star Wars games, a lot of Star Wars games, and a lot of Marvel games to play. And
a lot of LOTR kind of stuff, I would think.
Yeah, a lot of Lord of the Rings.
Right, yeah.
Harry Potter. One of my favorite games recently was a Harry Potter game.
It's really surprising because I definitely remember when I was a kid, if there was a game that was branded for a show or a movie, it was a bad game.
That's kind of what I was thinking, like the home version in
like
a way,
make
right?
It, yeah. Make it passable. Yeah. They'll buy it if it has so-and-so's face on it. But now I think more often than not, they're paying a lot of money for the license, so they want to make a lot of money off the game. So they make good games with the licenses.
It seems like it used to be that what they were trying to do is just reenact the actual plot of the movie.
Yeah.
But in a game form. And it's boring because, like, you already saw the movie. Yeah. But now it's so sophisticated and beyond these quests and these different things that are happening and different ways of winning. And as you say, in different character levels, like you're playing your B squad, you're over here playing, you know, as an Imperial stormtrooper somewhere. Someone is a bit player, but in the universe of Star Wars is massive, right? Interesting. But yeah, well, that's really amazing. So let's talk about Platypus Con in general. How long has it been going?
This will be our eighth event.
That's amazing. So you had, I'm guessing it maybe had to take a couple of years break there during COVID.
Just one.
Okay.
We came right, like we're normally in January and we'll be in January again. But we came in right before COVID was known well, I guess. It might have been in the U.S. already, but we didn't know about it. And so we had to skip the year. And then last time we were able to like meet the requirements to have a smaller event.
Yeah, very cool. And so this is back in black, man. It's like, here we go, back in Centennial Hall.
Yep.
Everyone back in there, 3 days. So tell me about the schedule and kind of what people can expect.
So the hours are 6 to 2 on Friday, and then 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday, and then 2 a.m. Thank you. And then 10 to 6 on Sunday.
Okay. Yeah. These are late night events. These gamers, this gets right. And this is all.
Yeah. It can go late into the night.
We want to work with early birds and night owls.
Yeah. Very cool. A lot of Red Bull, a lot of Cheetos. Maybe Cheetos are off limits when you're playing these games. I don't know.
I've never had too many qualms.
Okay.
The first year I was like, people are touching my things. I've gotten over it.
Now it's okay. It's fine.
Yeah, be respectful. And
yeah, I mean, don't do it and don't start licking my stuff or something.
Right. And tell me about kind of the different options for like if you want a 3-day pass or things like that, or how does that go?
So we can get a weekend pass for kids or adults. It's like 35 for an adult. Or you can get day passes if you only have 1 day of time for us, and that's $20 for an adult.
Yeah, very cool. And so when you walk into Centennial, is it the whole big room of Centennial that you've got?
The whole thing. We're using the full facility. The Egan Room, which some people might know, that's where we hold the library, which has like 2,200 games. But the main play space is the ballrooms.
So you go in to the library and you kind of check out a game and then you go find a table in the main space. Is that kind of how it goes? Or do you also have games already going that you know people are going to want to?
Both.
Yeah,
right.
And then there's a tournament area too. So we'll have tournaments. That's out in the main hallway.
And tell me about how the tournaments go. Is it kind of like an all weekend thing, and then there's kind of a final or?
So there'll be 9 games on tournament. They range from quick easy games to longer, more strategic games. They take about 45 minutes to play or so, and so the tournament's all weekend and trophies, and you're the state champion. So of that game,
we do like one tournament at a time. So. Like Azul will be Saturday and we'll play through all the, like we'll eliminate some people as we go and then finish it up on Saturday. So
tell me about the different, do you know it off the top of your head, the different games that are being played for the different tournaments?
I can try to get all 9, yeah. But I might not get all 9. One of the big ones we're starting up with Super Rhino, which is a dexterity game.
Super Rhino?
Yeah. So okay. you stack building walls and try not to knock it over. Since I'm going along the tooth of the descriptions, probably won't even do all 9. The big ones we're doing are Azul, which is a tile drafting game. So you start making a mosaic of floor, of pretty, very pretty tiles. Century Spice Road, which is probably one of our favorite easy to teach ones that we've taught a lot of people in Juneau because we're trying to do tournaments that people know how to play.
Yeah, sure.
Wordzy, which is a word game. Coup, where you're trying to essentially competitively lie to people. back to trick taking, we have Skull King and Diamonds, which are 2 trick taking games we didn't talk about. And I got most of them.
Shobu,
which is very chess-ish, but a lot simpler than chess, and we really like it. It's been very popular both at our other events and at Platypus Con.
And what was the one, Skull Game? Is that one?
Skull King.
Skull King? What's that one?
So it's trick-taking, but with pirates.
Oh, very good.
And it's even more chaotic because there's like 4 layers of Trump. So
yeah.
There's rum and booty involved.
There is. And mermaids.
And mermaids even. Well, that's awesome, you guys. And are you guys the founders of it? Or who are the people or the people that should be acknowledged as far as like kind of got this going through the years?
I'm the president, Jay's the secretary. We've both been here since the beginning.
Yeah, well, very cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome that you're doing it. And then outside of the convention, what's happening? Do you guys have ability or tell me more about, is there a business or Platypus?
Our main thing is the convention. We don't really have a brick and mortar type place.
Okay.
we partner a lot with Lask Robotics, which you mentioned.
Yeah.
Like, they'll probably start up some board game nights coming when we get to the darker months.
Well, they're moving into a new space that should be pretty cool. And got there'll
excited.
Be lots of room for that. So
and with the we've done game days at the library that have been pretty popular. So we've started doing those every last Sunday of the month.
All right. And, you know, it sort of couldn't be a more perfect town for doing board games. It's a lot of rain and a lot of dark, a lot of time to be just kind of hanging out and spending with friends.
True.
It is nice that we're not going to be haunted by very nice weather.
That's right. It is going to be solid rain. Well, Shay and Joshua, thanks so much for coming in. It's the Platypus Con. It's the board and card game extravaganza. It starts at 6 p.m. on Friday the 8th. It goes to 2 a.m. and then it goes from 10 a.m. to 2 a.m. Saturday, and then Sunday from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. And you can get all weekend passes or day passes or whatever. They'll set you up. Go in, check out all the 2,200 games that you have available to play and get coached and all that different stuff. It's all there for you to explore. And Joshua and Shay, thanks so much for coming in and letting us know about it. Sounds like it's going to be a great time. Appreciate
it. That's a blast.
All right.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Akhwan. The Kliné Di have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot once part of the tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages, and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations.
Hansen Gress, Ka eat with the Shu Yi, where Kashuk are ye tin. Jin kat ka ke jin talk, anachaya ha ani kach, gunish cheese.
That's a little Pablo Cruz right there. Speaking of cruise, let's talk about the cruise industry a little bit. Carla Hart is here. Carla is a co-founder and facilitator of the Global Cruise Activist Network, and she's going to be hosting a panel presentation on the health, quality of life, economic, and other impacts of the cruise industry on Juno Residence. Carla, thanks so much for coming. Appreciate having you here.
Thanks for letting me be here.
Interest of full disclosure, I work for Alaska Seaplanes, and I also serve on the board of Travel Juno. So those are interests that I have, but in my volunteer capacity here as a Juno Afternoon host is how I'm kind of operating today. But just to let people know that I have those responsibilities and interests as well. But anyway, Carla, let's talk about this.
Maybe just jump in first and say that I'm not against tourism. I made my living with independent tourism for 10 years. I am strongly supportive of tourism. I just think we need to have a different vision in it. Well, we need to have a vision, and it needs to be our proactive vision, not reactive.
Tell me about how the panel discussion is kind of looking at those issues and kind of trying to frame the discussion.
Right. So what I've done is found that this panel or forum, as I'm calling it now, evolved from frustration that the community in Juno isn't really getting a chance to learn in any depth about what's going on with the cruise industry in Juno and beyond our individual lived experiences, sort of how it's impacting us and what it's doing. And I have been studying the cruise industry for decades, and in the past 3 years have taken a really deep dive into the cruise industry, both globally and locally. And the more that I learn about different aspects, the more horrified and shocked I am that we as a community of smart people who care about the world and the environment and each other have completely failed in managing the the cruise industry impacts on our community.
Tell me when you say that you've been doing, because I've of course heard your name surrounding issues that have about the cruise industry for decades, but you're saying that in the past 3 years, you've done something a little bit different. Tell me about what you have been concentrating on the last 3 years.
Right. So in 2019, I for many summers have left Juneau in the summer because my home becomes unlivable because of the helicopter flight seeing traffic. I don't live near town. I could ignore and avoid most of the impacts, but I can't stay in my home because of the helicopter tour noise. And the volume of that noise is driven by the volume of cruise passengers coming to Juneau. 2019 circumstances were such that I had to spend the whole summer in Juneau. And by the time August came along, I had had enough and decided that if I could just organize with other people around the world who were facing similar overtourism from cruise ships, that maybe we could come to some, we could share knowledge and maybe we could make some difference in our communities. And so I started organizing a one-time conference in the fall of 2019. And then in 2020, the world took a turn with COVID. And by then, we'd already been using Zoom to work on organizing this conference globally. And so we just switched from organizing a conference to creating the Global Cruise Activist Network. And I'm the facilitator. And through that group, we've met every week to every 2 weeks since 2020 and had a lot of guest speakers and sort of the combination of a lot of people from a lot of places bringing together concerns has really opened my mind to things that I had never even thought of as concerns for Juneau before.
We should mention that on Friday, September 8th, this Friday, coming up at 6:30 p.m. at UAS Egan Lecture Hall, Room 112, that's where you're going to have this, you're going to be talking about this. Tell me about who is going to be, number one, the title of it is What About Us? So tell me, who's going to be, is it a panel discussion, right? So there's people.
It's going to be organized as a forum, and I'm going to be doing a lot of the presenting because I've taken a really deep dive into this, and 3 minute opportunities at the assembly non-agenda items just isn't enough to.
So it's really just showing a lot of your findings.
It's sharing a lot of my findings and raising some questions and recommendations for the assembly. And so I'm going to be doing a bunch of the speaking on, it's not really the dryer, but the fact-based. Here's these numbers, that numbers, here's how this is calculated, here's where this comes from, here's the data. And then to make it more human and sort of bring it to light, I've invited some different people from the community to come in and sort of tell their story of cruise impact. So I have Wanda Culp, who is from Huna and with the women. She's with an indigenous, a group of indigenous women that are concerned about the environment. And so Wanda is from Huna originally, moved to Juneau recently, and will be speaking a bit on her experience living in Huna and the cruise industry and then sort of global issues around cruise industry. Clayton Hamilton is someone I've just recently met who is a commercial fisherman, and he has some real concerns about the port and the harbors and the impacts on the commercial fishing fleet. And he's going to be sharing a letter that he wrote that he sent to 300 licensed commercial fishermen in Juneau. Stacey Eldemar is a longtime Juneau person who's going to share sort of her views and experiences of being here and how cruise impacts her life. And then Chris Pressing is a Thane Road resident and is going to share a bit about what it's like to go through the South Franklin Gauntlet and also highlight how that gauntlet is a public safety concern that almost cost somebody their life a few years ago.
So that's the panel, kind of that's the forum.
So it's going to be a forum. So yeah. I'm going to speak for a bit on a specific topic and then let someone come and tell a story and just give a break from me. And then I'll speak on another topic and then another speaker in between.
And is this kind of a part, you were mentioning that what you originally were doing was a one-time kind of thing. Is this a part of a series, or how do you kind of envision that discussion kind of going along? For right now, it's just a one-time thing.
It's a one-time thing right now. I I believe in the power of people to make a difference, and it's possible for an individual citizen to rent the Egan Lecture Hall and organize a forum and share information. And so I'm doing that. I am specifically not at this forum talking about some of the broader global and environmental impacts, which I think should be a real concern. We have sustainability goals, we have climate action goals in the city, and yet we put blinders on and pretend that all of the carbon footprint of the cruise industry and all of the scrubber wastewater that's dumped in the inside passage and everything just doesn't exist. So I think that would be a good opportunity for another forum, but one at a time.
Is there, when you, so the forum and you know, it's a discussion of ideas, is there then a specific, you know, is there an action you're looking to take at some point? Is there something that you think is maybe the goal of, you know, is there an assembly action or is there a state action or is there something like that that you're sort of targeting or looking at? Or
I'm a realistic idealist, so I wouldn't be doing any of this if I didn't think that it could help to move the lever on what's going on. I am going to have some suggested actions and recommendations that basically are directed at the assembly, because the assembly is who needs to take leadership on this and has failed to do so through decades. It's through city managers, through assemblies, through mayors. It's a very tough issue to take on. The cruise industry has a lot of power. They have a lot of capacity to tell their story. And we're all just trying to live our lives. And so it's been very easy to just react to what's happened and not take leadership. And so this is a call to the city to take leadership and for the assembly to truly and actually engage on understanding and prioritizing what's going on to, and this sounds dramatic, but to save our town from deteriorating into a place that a lot of us who make contributions to the community don't want to live anymore, and that independent tourists don't want to come to, and even that cruise passengers don't value. There are ports in the Caribbean that people all say, I don't even get off the port there. There's nothing to do. It sucks. It's dirty. It's yucky. They just want our money. Do we want to become that? I don't think so.
Well, that's a central question. And that's the forum titled, What About Us? And Carla Hart is the co-founder and facilitator of the Global Cruise Activist Network. And can you just one more time run through the other forum participants that you just said, just
sure,
their names real quick?
Sure. Yeah. Wanda Culp, Clayton Hamilton, Stacey Eldemar, and Chris Pressing. And one thing that I have, my technology skills are not the best, but we have set up an event on the Facebook, a Facebook group. The title is Streamed, What About Us? And the intent is to do a live stream from the event so that people who can't make it to the event in person and those who are in Sitka and Ketchikan who might find relevance in some of the information presented can listen. So again, it's Streamed, What About Us? On Facebook. I don't guarantee that'll work, but it's my intention.
It's going to be a good try. All right. And the live event's happening over at UAS Egan Lecture Hall, room 112, and that's happening Friday, September 8th at 6:30. Carla Hart, thanks so much for coming in and talking to us about this issue.
Thanks a lot, Andy.
Okay. Welcome back to your community-supported public media station, KTOO. It's Juno Afternoon. I'm your substitute host on this Wednesday, Andy Klein, filling in for Boston Christopher. I'm really glad to be with you today. And joining us next is Karen Silkaitis, the MFA Dean of the School of Arts and Sciences out at UAS, and also the next Evening at Egan Fall Lecture Series speaker, the first of this year, which is Fulbright scholar Dr. Shingo Hamada. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
It's great to see you again, Karen. Thanks for coming back in, letting us know all about such a cool thing that happens in Juneau, this little town we have, and yet we have these internationally known and celebrated speakers that come in and just fill our brains with amazing facts and stories. It's really terrific. Yeah.
It's such a great lecture series. Yeah. I have such a great time going to them. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we'll talk about the whole lecture series in a minute. It is exciting because it's the first of the series. So here we are, September. We're hitting it. It's the evening at Egan. And we're going to be talking about that for the next few months. And that's great. But Dr. Hamada, welcome to Juneau and welcome to our studio. Thanks so much
for
coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And so I'll let you kind of talk a little bit about your area of study. It's about herring, but it's not about the fish themselves, right? It's about the impact that fish has on communities in the Northern Pacific. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yes. I'm from Japan and I'm an anthropologist. I'm the somebody who doing the research on the culture of herring or the cultures around herring. So, you know, I cannot talk much about the herring fish itself. That's, we should ask the fisher biologist. Rather than that, and I'm looking at the relationship of human society with the herring, you know, how human society developed in a good way or bad way. With the herring resources,
is the herring as a catch? Are there certain things that happen technologically in order to be able to get that catch and consume it and those things? Is that part of it? Herring seems like such a versatile fish. There's so many products and things that come out of it, right? Yeah.
Yes, and a part of my research, of course, looking at the production side. That means like how fishermen catch herring, what kind of nets, the people use. But at the same time, I'm looking at how people eat herring, because, why we catch herring? Because we want to use herring resources for our life. So not only looking at how people catch herring, I'm looking at how people distribute herring and how people eat herring and also how people possibly wasting herring resources.
Is that, it seems like, I'm guessing there's very unique ways, depending on communities and maybe even isolated ways of catching, consuming. I think about in Sitka, the egg on kelp fishery that happens. I mean, is that something that also happens in other communities or is that unique or?
Well, the way native people here in South Alaska, Klingit people, Haida people harvest herring eggs, it's quite unique. Of course, that'll be done in First Nation people in Canada, but that's not something we don't see in Japan. We catch the herring and use the herring egg in a very different way from the people here in Southeast Alaska.
That's really interesting. The catch, and we'll talk about more evening at Egan in a minute, Karen, so thanks, but this is so interesting to hear this part of it. We think, obviously, here in Southeast Alaska, we're so tied to fish and fisheries, but we probably don't think too much about how that can be very different depending on the part of the world you're in. So what are some of the techniques, for example, for catching herring that happen in Japan that are very different than here?
Well, historically in Japan too, indigenous Ainu people use dip net, scoop up the herring because herring resources are so abundant. But as the time goes by, people make a mistake, catching herring too much. Then we start using gill net, pond net, trolling. So right now in the Japanese fishermen use a gill net.
Is overfishing of herring an issue in Japan right now? Is that something that's being looked at as a?
Well, that happened 100 years ago and about 50 years ago. So that's something that I want to talk in my evening lecture this Friday. But rather than that, I want to focus on how Japanese people try to reestablish the relationship with the herring resources in Japan because herring stock is recovering in Japan in the last 10 years, 15 years. So that's a good part. But at the same time, I want to emphasize how important to have a historical perspective and also how important to have a voice and idea of the relationship with the herring from an indigenous people's perspective.
It's such an interesting thing about fisheries in general. As fish get less scarce, the methods can become even more efficient,
right?
Which therefore can compound this problem, right? All of a sudden you're catching all the fish in a very efficient way. And if you don't have a really strict way of managing it, then it can spiral out of control, right, and you can lose fisheries, like cod fisheries, mm-hmm, things like that that happen, mm-hmm, in the Northeast, you know. So, and I think in Alaska was learning that lesson with really efficient salmon wheels in the 50s. And, you know, that was a big part of establishing fish and game and sort of the management practices that are behind that. So it's really interesting to hear that Japan has gone through these same sort of things. It makes sense that, you know, maritime cultures would all kind of maybe go through similar cycles like that.
Right, right. So the seafood or the maritime resources are very important for the both sides of North Pacific. So I hope we can learn from the past and the present situation of our relationship with herring resources, you know, from each other.
Well, Karen, this sounds amazing. Sounds totally fascinating. I'm hooked. No pun intended. tell us more about the other stuff that's happening on the lecture series.
So we're really excited to welcome the Juneau community back in person. We want, of course, our evening and Egan lectures are always live streamed on the UAS YouTube channel, so people can tune in that way. They're at 7 p.m. They're, of course, they're free and open to the public. But we're really excited to get Juneau community back at the library. So please feel free to come on down and see us in person. So of course, this Friday, we're really excited to be with Shingo, and please come and hear his lecture. The next one is going to be on October 13th. And I think so many people have an experience with a friend or a family member who has suffered from dementia or something where we talk about brain health, right? And so we have Dr. Rosalyn Rosich is coming to talk about the title of her lecture is The Vicissitudes of Aging and Brain Health, What Parents May Never Have Told You. And she's going to kind of give us the updated research and give us some tips, actually, that can lead to a vibrant discussion about aging and our brain health. And I'm super excited to listen to that. I know that my own family members have been affected. So
it's an interesting thing, you know, especially speaking to, you know, university students may not be the forefront of their thought process of what happens in aging.
Yeah.
But to be really just thinking about that and discussing that at the university, fascinating.
Well, sure, she's going to talk
about— a brand new frontier of science that's happening, understanding what's happening in—
absolutely
—that development.
She's going to talk about modifiable lifestyle behaviors that we can adapt, you know, adopt now or adopt when you're young, right? And talk about the aging process. So I do think it's going to be a really interesting lecture. Then on November 10th, another super interesting topic to Juneau, I think, impacts and responses, cruise ships and northern communities. And that's going to be Dr. Jim Powell, who's one of our research professors at UAS. There was a film that was made called new documentary film called Cruise Boom that was set in Sitka, created by Ellen Frankenstein. So it was a documentary film that followed and raised questions relevant to Southeast communities set in Sitka. And this topic, so Jim Powell is going to come in and ask two questions. One is, how can communities shape tourism? And also, how can mass tourism become regenerative? So definitely, it was a multidisciplinary research team funded by the National Science Foundation. So we're going to look at Juneau's cruise industry, I think have a vibrant chat about cruise ship tourism in a Alaska, and in kind of northern communities. And then our last lecture, I'm personally very invested in because I'm participating. It's on December 8th, and it's going to be a really vibrant, exciting night, a very creative night. We're calling it the Winter Fire Showcase. And it's going to be Ernestine Hayes and Lily Hope and Emily Wall and myself. And we're going to do a really performative night of readings, poetry and performances in our Winter Fire Showcase. So come on out and listen to us perform for you.
Wow. Well, three, four prominent names there for sure. And that'll be really cool. You know, one thing, Dr. Hamada, I wanted to ask you about is, you know, we were talking a little bit about some of the specifics of communities and how they differ. But obviously, climate change, things like that would immediately come to mind when you think about how fish stocks are changing. So are there things there that you've looked at, and what are some of the findings that you've got there if you have?
Well, of course, I'm not the specialist in the climate change, but, as I spend so much time in the local fishermen, the climate change is a really hot topic. You know, there's the front line of the experience in the climate change. You know, the herring used to be here a lot, even like in Juneau, you know, when, you know, Aquan people here and they're catching herring. No, we don't see herring here now, right? So, you know, the climate change, of course, you know, the local fishermen talk about climate change. So, of course, that's a part of the, my research, you know, listen to you know, how local people perceive, recognize, adapt to the climate change is a part of my research as well. But at the same time, you know, there's the things we as an individual can do for to mitigate climate change. But at the same time, you know, for the resource management, that's much you know, much easier to, you know, tackle on, I think, you know, we can, you know, we can, it's hard to, you know, deal with the climate change personally, but, you know, as a scholar and as an individual, you know, I hope I can talk to as many people as possible and talk about the importance of resource management if we cannot change the climate change, you know, in a single day.
You know, one other thing that I was wondering about, and I don't know if there's even an answer to this, but you specifically look at herring and the impact on herring. Are there almost indicators that you look at and say like, oh, that's a herring culture? Like, oh, I recognize this from a Japanese culture I studied or from another thing. Like that's typical of a culture that's grown up around harvesting herring.
Well, that's a good question. Well, this is not specifically herring culture, like, oh, this is herring culture things. But when I, you know, went to Sitka for the first time in the year 2012, you know, local Kulingi people invited me for dinner. And that was the first time that I had a you know, herring egg on brunch. And at that time, you know, he said, you know, you can eat this with, you know, wasabi soy sauce. And that's I feel like, well, that's a Japanese culture. But, you know, this, what do you mean Japanese culture? You know, we use wasabi and the soy sauce. Of course, you know, he talked about the seal oil. So sure. That's one of the reasons why I'm become interested in the consumption part of, you know, the fishery as well, because people love talk about how much they can catch herring or the salmon, the halibut, but at the same time, they are so eager to talk about how they eat fish. What kind of soy sauce they use. You know, they don't want to, you know, they want to eat the fish with rice or bread or the spaghetti, those kind of things as well. So, of course, and I can see a lot of influence from you know, Japanese food culture in South Alaska. But at the same time, you know, I don't want to like say like, oh, this is Japanese culture. This is a native culture, you know. The culture, you know, we have a lot of culture exchanges and the culture change. And, I hope, you know, we can come up with a better way, more sustainable way of eating herring and a better way of a better, you know, relationship with the herring.
It's a really, that's fascinating, isn't it? We're having a cultural exchange through herring without even really realizing it in a way, right? I mean, that idea of eating it with a condiment that is something that's a Japanese developed condiment. It's so interesting to hear that's an actual cultural exchange that's happening on your plate.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really fascinating. And then just one other question I had was we're sort of familiar with some of the ways that herring is consumed and processed here in Alaska. What are some of the unique ways that that's done in Japan?
Well, unique way of Japan. Well, I would say, you know, in Japan, we use fermenting technology a lot for the food preservation. Because in Japan, we have a very hot and humid summertime. It's really hard to live. But at the same time, that's a great environment to develop the fermenting, you know, food culture. So we use the fermentation technology to preserve herring fish.
So it's fermented, and by fermenting it, so like, almost like a pickling kind of, or tell me about the fermentation process.
Yeah, it's a pickle, you know, it's a pickling, but we don't use the vinegar. Instead, you know, we use the rice bran. Yeah, rice bran, and also we use the with a koji, it's a different kind of, it's not bios, I'm sorry, it's the bacteria to use to ferment it in the fish and enhance the umami flavor. So not only to, you know, make a food life longer, to preserve it, preservation, we use the fermentation technology to make fish taste better.
Enhance the flavor as well. Yeah, right. Well, of course. Well, it's totally very fascinating to talk to you about this. And it's such an interesting thing to think about how this one type of species affects these, you know, kind of these cultures that are going across all of the North Pacific, you know. One last question I had for you: what are the communities that you've studied in Alaska?
Well, in Alaska, you know, I just started doing my research, but I want to say that before I start doing the research, it's very important to build a relationship with local people first. So, so far, I went to town of Craig, and I went to Sitka several times, and I was fortunate enough to meet with some local people and to listen to their experience with herring. But at the same time, and that's part of my research, but at the same time, I want to emphasize that I'm still in the process of developing the relationship with the local Haida people and Kalingit people, and show that, you know, I'm not, you know, here to, you know, culture appropriate, you know.
Oh, no.
I want to, you know, share my knowledge that I learned from Japanese side, and I learned, you know, from, you know, people here, so that, you know, with throughout the mutual learning, you know, and the communicating, you know, I hope we can come up with a better way to, you know, have a relationship with the herring. I'm just repeating this phrase because this is my, you know, the research goal, you know, how to come up with a sustainable herring seafood culture in the both side of North Pacific.
Right. Well, it's thank you so much for your time today. It's fascinating to talk to you about this. And the Evening at Egan Fall Lecture Series kicks off this Friday with Fulbright scholar Dr. Shingo Hamada, who we've been talking to, and Karen Silkaitis. Thanks so much for coming in as well and telling us all about not just this one that's coming up, but also the full series. Time and one more time for people
7 p.m. in the Egan Library on the UAS campus.
And it's a discussion of Eating the Herring: Rifts and Responses in the North Pacific is the title of it, and a fascinating topic of discussion. Thanks to both of you for coming in, and congratulations on the start of another great new Evening at Egan lecture series. So great. I mean, it makes fall not so dreary. You know, it's great. We've got that to look forward to every month.
Well, thanks for having us.
Yeah, very good. All right. Thanks to both of you so much. Well, that's going to do it for Juneau Afternoon, broadcast live on KTOO 104.3 FM, online at kto.org, and rebroadcast on the station at 7 p.m. For more information on the show or to listen to past shows, you can go to kto.org/JuneauAfternoon. Boston Christopher is our producer, and we had help today from Aaron Tripp. Thanks, Aaron. Theme music is by Indian Agent, and I'm Andy Klein, your host for today on a Wednesday. Really fun to be in here for an extra day this week. Thanks, Boston, for letting me take your place for a day. Hope you have a good day, everyone.